Well, this world is filled with things to do. There are so many things to do, places to go, people to see that one can scarcely begin in a lifetime. Most people today are busy running here and there, seemingly never having enough time to do everything. Are there enough hours in your day? Probably not. But of all of the running and doing and expending of energy, how much of it is really important? Be honest in answering that question. We're at church. You have to be honest. God is watching. Think back to yesterday. What did you do or accomplish yesterday that was really important? Did you do anything yesterday that gives you great satisfaction upon reflection today? And more importantly, did you do anything at all yesterday that caught the attention of God? Anything that God would be particularly pleased with? If you can't think of anything yesterday, how far back would you have to go to find something you'd done that was especially pleasing to God? Now, I think we all will have to admit that most of our running, our doing, and our going isn't very important in the scheme of things. If all we can say we've accomplished in our lives is that we ate, we slept, we shopped, we bathed, we watched television, then that's pretty sad. 365 days like that times 80, that's my life. That's the definition of my life. 365 days like that times 80, and that equals my life. That would be pretty sad, wouldn't it? Jesus Christ said something in Matthew 23 that is quite profound. Matthew chapter 23. In verse 23, easy to remember this verse. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! You pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faith. These you ought to have done without leaving the others undone. So Jesus Christ chides the Pharisees for neglecting the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faith. The point is, these Pharisees were busy tithing. They were going to the synagogue. They were busy doing alms. They were doing religious stuff. But these things weren't producing the real spiritual character that God wanted to see. You can do what seems like spiritual things and not really be advancing spiritually. Staying busy is not the same as accomplishing and producing in the eyes of God. Do we have time for all the little things and never seem to get around to the really important matters in life? What are the weightier matters of the law and of life itself? Do we always find time to cut the grass and work in the garden? We always find time to clean up the house and change the oil in the car? Shop for food and clothes? Why is it we can always find time to have dinner? No matter how busy we are, we could find time for dinner. Or for your favorite television show, whatever it may be. You know, if it's 8 o'clock Tuesday night and your favorite show is on, you could be the busiest person in the world, but you find time to watch it, or at least record it and watch it some other time. Find time to wash the clothes, change the baby, eat 3 meals a day, and take the dog for a walk every day of our lives. But is there time in our lives for the weightier matters? Those items which catch the attention of God and build real godly character into our minds that prepare us for the arrival of God's kingdom and advance God's work here on earth? Or are we just busy without accomplishing anything? Now you notice, those are a lot of questions. Do I have any answers? I brought a couple of answers along for all the questions. Romans chapter 12 and verse 1. Romans chapter 12 and verse 1. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. So Paul writes the word here, I beseech, that is beg, implore, importune. He writes this sentence with great passion and great feeling and great emotion. What are those things which are pleasing to God that build righteous character that are acceptable to God? Paul goes on in the rest of the chapter to amplify what some of those weightier matters are. These are things that we need to be building into our lives on a daily basis. In fact, verses 9 through 21 tell us how to present our bodies as living sacrifices to God. And I intend to peruse that section today. I love that word, peruse. It implies it's going to be short. Verse 9, let love be without, and the King James says, dissimulation. The New King James says, hypocrisy. To dissemble means to hide one's true feelings. It means to pretend, thus hypocrisy or favoritism. You know, it is really simple to love people who love us. Did you notice that? Somebody loves you, it's not so hard to love them. It's easy to like people that appeal to us. If you're an intellectual or you're well-to-do or you're sports-oriented, you have friends who like those things. But that's easy to do. The world does that. You call that lightweight spirituality. It's not wrong, it's just easy. It's just easy. There's nothing wrong with it. But it is not weighty. It is not weighty. Because the Serbs do it, the Croats do it, the Arabs do it, the Jews do it, Sunnis do it, Shiites do it, atheists do it, Buddhists do it, Hindus do it. Everybody in the world does it. People love people who love them. And so everybody finds this relatively easy to do. Have we ever gone out of our way to build, though, a warm, friendly relationship with someone who is different in his social position, interest, or education than we are? Different? If you have, we might call that middleweight spirituality, but it's still not weighty. Not even that. That's not weighty. What about building a close, loving relationship and friendship with someone who, by every indication, is someone we just can't stand? We cannot get along with. It's like fingernails on a blackboard. You know, just thinking about it sends chills up and down my spine. When that person comes around, it's like, wow, we just cannot seem to get along with that person no matter what we do. You know, a wise person once said, the best way to destroy your enemy is to make him your friend. When we make those kinds of attempts and succeed, God will notice. God will notice, because then we're doing something that everybody in the world doesn't do. We're doing something that is rare. We will begin to garner the attention of the Almighty, because now we're accomplishing something meaningful. May I add, you are accomplishing something then weighty spiritually. Has substance to it, has weight to it. We're beginning to build the character of Jesus Christ when we spend our time and energy building friendships and relationships with all whom God calls, everyone without exception, as we heard to a certain degree in the sermonette today. Again, it is no accident, as I look out over this congregation, that we are a diverse lot. We would not know one another just socially or whatever, except for God's calling, most likely. What is it that has brought us together from different backgrounds, different social status, different educational levels, different races, different experiences? Here we are all together. Well, you know, God is not going to send us out in the world tomorrow to help teach all nations until we learn how to get along with many different types of people. And so, in one sense, the congregation is a grand experiment where we get to practice on getting along with people who are not like we are. We're different. And in some cases, very different. When I pastored the Baltimore congregation, back in the early 1980s, I conducted many funerals. In fact, I don't know if it's still there. There was this funeral parlor in downtown Baltimore, and it was like a funeral factory. It had sometimes six services going on at one time. And every time I went there, there was a lady trying to get me to hire her to sing for our services. Of course, you had to pay her. She said, I do all services. And boy, could she sing. You could hear. I thought, wow, if she sings any louder, she'll wake the dead. She had some voice. But there were many funerals that I conducted there where I was the only Caucasian there. I was the only Caucasian. And I could just feel the eyes on the back of my head as I walked up to conduct services. Now, Mr. Oakley, my associate, he had the opportunity to go out into the hinterlands, you know, of Maryland, Westminster and beyond to conduct a funeral or whatever. And same thing happened to him out there. He was the minority of one, you know, in the midst of the plains people from German background or whatever. And so it is no accident that God has called in many congregations a diverse lot of people. Some of the most segregated places on the face of this earth, the United States today, and Western culture are still churches. Churches and institutions of higher learning. It's amazing here. So it's for our good that we are from all different backgrounds, come from all different places, all of us. Now, I'll have to admit this, that some people are going to be real challenges. Getting along with some people, like Bill Ripien, I'm just joking. Some people will be real challenges. In my rookie days as a minister back in the late 1960s, my wife and I went to visit a lady in the Midwest, church member. But nearly everyone in the congregation there in Evansville, Indiana, could not stand this lady. They see her coming, they'd run for the doors. It was like she had a thundercloud that personally followed her around that she walked under. She was outspoken. She had a vitriolic and caustic tongue. She was critical about everything and everybody. She was angry looking. She was married to a quiet man over whom she ruled the roost. She used to say things like, "Boy, you look sick today." Or if a baby cried at church, she'd go up to the mother and say, "Why don't you train that baby better so it doesn't bother the rest of us?" And I am not exaggerating. Well, we determined, as a rookie, what did I know? But we determined we were going to do everything possible to make this woman our friend. So we visited her often. She was suspicious. "He's just here to snoop. He's here to see if I've got, I don't know, back then, white sugar in the sugar bowl or whatever, to get ammunition for sermons about repentance or whatever it might have been." We looked at her flower garden. We inspected all of her quilts. We marveled at her canning prowess. We had her teach us how to play canasta. In fact, that's the last time I played canasta. And it's interesting, now that I think back, when I thought I was actually, we thought we were winning a hand of canasta, she would introduce a new rule to us that she hadn't told us about. So that we never, I need to play canasta again so I can find out if she was cheating us here. We parried her barbs with jokes, and we let her know that we really did like her, and that was not put on. We really did like her. There was something about her we liked, and we wanted her for a friend. She began to confide in us. She developed a fondness for our little baby, Cliffy, who's now 42 years old. It always helps if you try to do something like this to have a baby along. Have you ever noticed the most sour person in the world, you know? See a little baby laughing at him, he'll just have a hard time not smiling at a cute little baby. She started bringing things for us at church from her garden. Then the congregation started whispering. "Do the Demarests really like this woman? Don't they know what a bad person this lady is? Why do they spend so much time with this lady? Don't they know that she is not a nice person? That tough old hide of hers was covering a pretty tender heart. Down underneath all that bad stuff, there was some pretty good stuff. Once you got through the bad stuff. I, in the course of time, rebaptized her. She cried at the baptism. She said on the way to the baptismal water, down to the basement steps, to the baptismal tank, "Do you think there is any hope for an old fool like me?" She's a different woman today, and I count that as one of our, my wife and I, greatest accomplishments in the ministry. It isn't wrong to love those who love us and to like those who like us or be friends with those who like the same things that we like. There's nothing wrong with that at all. But if we spend all of our time with these people who are easy to be friends with, are we really a living sacrifice? What are we sacrificing? What have we sacrificed to build that friendship? Are we to the meat of God's Word? Is that a weighty accomplishment spiritually? When we come to church, it should be a time to work at building friendships with all of those whom God has called, every single one. And so if you look around here and you've been attending for a while and there's someone you don't know very well, I have a little quiz for you right now for the congregation here. Write down the names of three of your best friends in the church. Don't write down the name of your wife or your husband, please, your child. Write down the names of three of your best friends in the church. Any congregation, anywhere. First name will do. No one's going to check this. You people stop looking at your neighbor's notes now here. All right. Question number two, this is only two questions. What is the greatest difference in years, of the ages, of any of those people to yourself? You understand? If you're 40 and your best friend's 35, it would be five years. All right, now let's grade you. 10 points for each person who's at least 10 years younger or older than you. 20 points for each person who's at least 20 years younger or older than you. 30, you get my drift. And 40 points if your best friend, any of your best friends, is 40 years younger or older than you. So if you're 65 and you have a 25-year-old best friend, you get 40 points. You can get more than 100 on this test. But I suspect most of the scores are somewhat lower than that. All of us need to put forth the effort with the Spirit of God to build a friendship with someone who is different from us and has different interests than we do. I've met some people so small-minded, not necessarily in the church, but so small-minded that if you liked a certain sports team, they couldn't possibly be your friend. That's pretty narrow, let me tell you. That limits things to quite a degree. Since we've moved in so many places, 22 times since we've been married, we've lived in all kinds of areas and we rooted for whatever team was there. So now people ask me, and I can't begin to think of who my favorite sports team is. We were Baltimore Orioles fans, but now it's more like Tampa Marlins. One of the reasons Herbert W. Armstrong was so impressed with Anwar Sadat of Egypt was that he was willing to take the first step toward establishing friendship with an enemy. And that was a great risk to his own safety and life. He was still willing to do it, and of course you know what happened shortly after that. He was assassinated. But it struck Mr. Armstrong that here was a world leader who was willing to take that risk, take the first step to try to make peace with an enemy. If we can build a strong friendship with someone who by every standard is someone we should not get along with at all, somebody who rubs us the wrong way, then we are discovering and practicing a weightier matter of God's law. And this talent will be critical if God is going to send us out as His agents in the world tomorrow to reconcile people of every conceivable background to Him. What are we going to do with the former Muslims of the world and Hindus of the world and atheists of the world and whatever? People from such diverse backgrounds, if we met them today, we probably wouldn't be able to think of anything to say. All right, back in Romans chapter 12, I spent a lot of time on that first point. Number two in verse 9 is, abhor that which is evil. Abhor that which is evil. Someone who jumps out of his chair, her chair, turns the television set off. Turns it off. Well, actually, I guess you would hit the clicker now. Hit the clicker and turn it off. When two of the beautiful people start romancing, do I need to elaborate if you get my drift? Which is probably most of the shows now. Someone who will not just sit there and watch what God considers to be an abomination, which is most of what we see in our movies and on television, right? Am I wrong? The Greek carries the meaning here, the connotation of to detest with horror. To detest with horror. It is stronger than hate. Stronger than hate. Have we ever walked out of a movie, clicked off the television, refused to laugh at jokes? There must be passion in our view toward evil and passion in our view toward good. God has called us to be passionate people. Passionate against evil and passionate for the truth. And then in Romans chapter 12, verse 9, it adds, cling to what is good. Abhor that which is evil, cling to what is good. Be cemented or glued to what is good. Have an unalterable attachment to whatever leads to God and contributes to the welfare of others, is the sense. Cling to the truth, in other words. Cleave to your mate. Cling to your family. Cling to the work of God. Cling to the right way to live. Cling to holy time. To honesty, moral purity, moderation. Cling to God. Hold on for dear life. Hold on, you know, as tight as you can to these things. And then in verse 10, be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love. It is actually quite difficult to translate this phrase here. It signifies having that affectionate regard which every Christian should feel for one another, especially in the body of Christ, especially in the church. It is indescribable affection, most clearly demonstrated in a mother's love toward her child. Not just caring for one another, but to delight in caring for one another, to actually delight in caring for one another. A parent sometimes approaches this standard as she or he walks the floor at night with a child who is sick. You notice I said he or she walks the floor at night with a child who is sick. When I was a small child, I was susceptible to numerous abscess earaches. And when I got those earaches, there was nothing that could relieve the pain. And my mother used to come in the room and pick me up and carry me into the guest room and sit down in her wooden rocker and sing to me and rock me for hour after hour, even though she needed to be up early the next day. And she would sing to me in Swedish. Or should I say Swedish? I wish I had listened a little more intently. I only learned a few things. One thing I remember in Swedish is Hålla tungan. Hold your tongue. That seems to be one that we heard often. It goes on in Romans chapter 12 to say, in honor, giving preference to one another. The meaning appears to be, consider all our brethren as more worthy than we. And don't let grief or envy affect our minds at seeing another honored and us neglected. Now, this is a tough one. This is a weightier matter. This is a hard lesson. Adam Clark says in his commentary in this section, we have no objection to the elevation of others, providing we be at the head. But who can bear even to be what he calls neglected? How many of us can really stand to be neglected? Can we stand ever to be neglected? Do we ever feel like we're being neglected? Others should be doing more things to help us. Other people, the church, should be doing more to help me. The government should be doing more to help me. Alleviate our problems, caring more for our needs. Every congregation I've ever been in, some people have told me at one time or another, this is a cold church, it's cliquish. Now you hear that all the time, it's cliquish or it's a cold church. That's the wrong focus. If it is a cold church, if it is cliquish, then I might ask, are you a part of it or are you not a part of it? That perhaps God placed you in the congregation to do something about it. Because it is, after all, our church. You know, we're all part of that same body. We may very well have lots of needs, but as long as they remain our focus, we will never get to the weightier matters of the law. The Jews have a very interesting custom on the Feast of Purim. And this is just a custom they have. And that is, on the Feast of Purim, you are to find somebody who is poorer than you are and buy them a present. That's what they do on Purim. Now, the lesson is marvelous for Christians. Find somebody who's lonelier than you are and cheer them up. Find someone whose body hurts more than yours does and cheer that person up. Find, you know, whatever you are experiencing, find somebody who's got similar difficulties or greater challenges, and you cheer them up. That is why God placed all of us in the body, to be our brother's keeper. Now, I was a feast coordinator for 8 years, and I'll have to say I learned a tremendous amount being a festival coordinator. And the one main talent that a feast coordinator needs is he needs to have an overview of everything that's going on. You know, if the feast coordinator ever got sick or were an accident or whatever, the feast might fall apart in some areas because everything is up in his head as to how it all holds together. But I would have many people come in the office and say things like this. We need more activities for singles. Can we have more attention paid to the teenagers? Or more attention for children's activities? Or senior citizens? Or widows? Or French-speaking Canadians? Or whatever it was. Now, guess who came in asking these questions? The singles came in asking about singles activities. Senior citizens would come in asking about senior activities. Teenagers would come in asking about teen activities. You know what was very rare? The senior citizen coming in and asking about teenage activities. A teenager or young adult coming in and asking about what we could do for the senior citizens. That happened once in a while, and when someone came in with that view, it was like, boy, my ears perked up, and I just thought, you know, he looked at the person like, here's someone whose interests are a little wider than just, you know, my friends and my group. So we should think, God called us personally to His church, to be the first fruits of the kingdom of God, to live forever. He ransomed us from the penalty of death through the sacrifice of Jesus Christ for our sins. Neglected? Are any of us neglected? How could anyone say they were neglected in light of God ransoming us with the life of His Son and offering to us His Spirit and the potential to live forever? How could we consider ourselves ever neglected in the grand scheme of things? God has lavished His attention on us and offered us all things. It is a matter of perspective. God didn't call us and make us His first fruits so that we could be served by others. He called us all to serve. And God knew that we were single, handicapped, poor, elderly, lonely, depressed, abused, angry, divorced, whatever. When He called us, God knew who we were and what our background. God knows everything in your life. Things you probably have never told another human being on this earth that's gone on in your life. God knows it, and He saw it and He understood it when He called you into the faith. And He offers us His Spirit to be able to deal with it so we might be a helper to others. And that brings us now to the point I want to focus on lastly in verse 13. Distributing to the needs of the saints. The King James puts it this way, distributing to the necessity of the saints. It's a very interesting phrase here. It certainly refers to the responsibility of those who have been blessed financially to help those in need. It certainly can be applied in that way, without a doubt. But if that's the only way it could be applied, then a lot of us would be left out. Don't limit the fulfillment of this verse to just money. Each member of the body is unique. Each of us has different strengths, and each of us has different needs. Everyone has needs. Everyone. There are many more needs in a congregation than just financial ones. There is a need for a shoulder to cry on, an ear to listen, an encouraging word, rides to activities, friendships to overcome loneliness, examples of good marriages, good child-rearing habits, good health, good role models of masculinity and femininity, especially in this culture. We need good examples of Christian femininity and masculinity. Senior citizens who befriend teenagers, and we need certainly an understanding of cultural differences and differences in backgrounds of people. The list is limitless. I love the commercial. It was on down in Florida. I haven't seen it for a while. Where the guy brings this elderly lady lunch. Meals on Wheels, I don't know what the program was, but he brings her lunch. And he comes in, he puts it down. Now, Mrs. La Rosa, here's your lunch. She looks up, she's quite elderly. Obviously, she's got lots of difficulties in her life. And she puts out this faint smile. But then he steps back and he starts singing to her in Italian. And maybe I should have David Jackson sing a few bars of Old Solo Mio. And once he starts singing in Italian, because her name being La Rosa, she lights up like a beacon. When he starts, you know, because it brings back all these wonderful memories to her. He knew exactly what she needed. See? He's thinking about what her needs are. She needed something more than food. So are we using our talents to distribute to the needs of others in the congregation? Everybody has needs. As I said, every person has needs. In every congregation there are super deacons and super deaconesses, some ordained and some unordained. By that I mean people who have tremendous hearts of service who seem to be everywhere there is a need, and you usually find out from someone else. When I was a pastor in West Palm Beach and I started visiting the members down there, people would tell me, oh, I needed this fixed and Mr. So-and-so was over here to fix. I needed a ride to the hospital and he took me and waited 3 hours while I was there. And after a year or two, you realize this man is everywhere. Plus, he was 80 years old. And so I ordained him after a few years of being there as a deacon in the congregation. You know Mr. Scribner. Had a heart of service. And he didn't ask for any attention, you know, whatsoever. When I ordained him as a deacon, I had more members of the congregation come up to me and say, that was really appropriate. He really, really, really has helped the church. And now he's 87 or 88 and he's still going, helping as much as he can. So there are always needs in a congregation. Did you realize that even these people, though, have needs? Superdeacons, elders, others have needs. Sometimes zealous servers find it very difficult to let someone serve them. This is a phenomenon I've seen as a pastor over the years. People were zealous in serving and giving and helping others, but you try to do something for them, and it's almost impossible to help. They may have spent 20, 30 years giving financial assistance to people, helping them out, but let's say they get in financial difficulties at a certain time. It's very hard for some of these people to accept it, even though they may need it. I've had some talks with some of our super servers over the years, some of them elders in the church, and encouraged them to use more wisdom in their service. Burned out and unable to serve anyone at 50 is not as good as being able to serve a little less, but to do it till you're 80 or 85 or 90 years of age. One of my wife's favorite saying is, dead heroes serve no one. Dead heroes serve no one. See? So we do need to use wisdom along those lines. So what's the answer? Philippians chapter 2. Philippians 2. And verse 19. But I trust in the Lord Jesus to send Timothy to you shortly, that I also may be encouraged when I know your state. For I have no one like-minded who will sincerely care for your state. You know, here is a young man who just naturally seemed to care about people. Once in a while you run into a person like that, they just seem to really care about everybody. My mother-in-law was that way. My mother-in-law just seemed to care about everyone. She was interested in everyone. My mother was that way to a great degree too. Stop and talk to whomever. Became good friends with everybody at the supermarket and everybody they passed in the street that had a sign that would say, we'll work for food. Talk to them and see if there were a need and try to help them out some way. And it's refreshing when you run into someone like that. For all seek their own, not the things which are of Christ. Do you know his proven character, that as a son with his father, he served me in the gospel, helped the Apostle Paul greatly. Therefore, I hope to send him at once as soon as I see how it goes with me, but I trust in the Lord that I myself shall also come shortly. And then verse 25, yet I consider it necessary to send to you Epaphroditus, my brother, fellow worker and fellow soldier, but your messenger and one who ministered to my need. The Apostle Paul. You know, we think of him as being one of God's greatest servants. Even under inspiration from God, he wrote, I'm not one whit behind the chiefest of the apostles. He served God mightily once God called him. But Paul here admits, I have needs. I have needs. Apostles have needs. Herbert W. Armstrong had needs. Gerald Waterhouse had needs. Some of you remember Gerald Waterhouse? Some of you do. 3-hour sermons. That was the average. You know what his longest one was? Did I ever tell you his longest sermon? 5 hours and 37 minutes. South Africa. And when he was finished, people wanted him to go on. And I was telling my son Chad, he used notes for a sermon on a 3x5 card. That was his notes. Mr. Waterhouse made 13 world tours. He traveled around in the days of the Radio Church of God and the Worldwide Church of God, the world, 13 times, visiting every congregation. We were 175,000 members then. And he'd visit every single congregation, did it 13 times. I was shocked when his brother, Don, who's one of our ministers in South Carolina, told me that, you know, in those 13 world tours covering 30 years, he'd never missed a sermon because of sickness. In traveling around the world, I mean, to every continent and every nation just about on this earth, he'd never missed a flight. Never lost a piece of luggage. Now, please, I mean, I can't travel up here without losing my luggage or somebody losing it for me. But I am very grateful that although I didn't make it onto the golf tour or become a professional golfer, that I have a love for golf because it put me in contact with him a lot. Now, he was a flawed man, as Mr. Armstrong was, without a doubt. But his strong points certainly outweighed the negative ones. And the more time I spent with Mr. Waterhouse, just socially, the more I realized he had lots of needs. He was always filling the needs of others, but you think, wow, he must have thousands of friends. He had thousands of acquaintances. It's hard for him to get to make really close friends. And I also realized that he had a very lonely life. Different hotel every night, different congregation every day. And so, you know, when you get behind the veneer and you see, and I began to realize that he wants to go play golf. I was in Baltimore, he's in New Jersey, he wanted me to come up. Mr. Oakley used to ask, can I come too, and play golf. I began to realize, you know, he needs me to come because he needs, you know, that kind of an outlet. So everybody has needs. Ministers have needs. The first minister I worked for in 1967, Bob Steep, he told me about the widows in Salem, Kentucky. And he said, every time I'm depressed, every time I've had a hard day, if I'm anywhere around Salem, I can stop by these two or three widows' homes and they will cheer me up. Of course, it helped that they all knew how to make blackberry cobbler. I mean, real blackberry cob, picked the blackberries, made it themselves, and homemade ice cream on top of it. We used to call that minister's comfort food. And so they thought we were cheering them up, but they, in fact, were cheering us up because they always had Bible questions. I mean, notebooks full of Bible questions. Notebooks full of Bible questions. One little lady, she lived in a house, and she paid $4 a month for rent. And she lived on $65 a month. Now, I know that was 1967, but $65 a month and $4 for rent. So they had almost nothing, but what they had was priceless. They had the ability to cheer us all up and make us forget our difficulties. So ministers have needs. Elders have needs. I'll bet David Jackson has needs. Deacons have needs, senior citizens have needs, middle-aged people, married couples, single teens, everybody has needs. What are those needs? What are they? How do you find out? You can't find out in a superficial conversation. You don't tell someone really what's going on in your life you just met, have you? You don't really open up to someone unless you're comfortable with them, right? You must get to know the seniors, middle-aged, teens, children, all of them in the congregation. My wife likes to go around and talk to children at church. You know, and sometimes you can see two or three adults, you know, waiting to speak to my wife while she's talking to a four-year-old. And the message they're sending is, why are you wasting your time with a four-year-old when I have something important to talk to you about? Well, I hope none of us ever think that way. Verse 26 here in Philippians, going on. Since he was longing for you, that is Epaphroditus, and was distressed because you had heard that he was sick. Typical reaction of people that are super servers, that like to, you know, go out and help everybody. He was distressed because other people were concerned about him. You see what's going on here? It concerned him that people were concerned about him. Some find it tougher to be served than to serve. They will not let you serve them. I've had to explain to some people over the years that it's just as much a part of God's law to receive help as it is to give it. Verse 27, for indeed he was sick, almost to death, but God had mercy on him, and not only on him, but on me also, lest I should have sorrow upon sorrow. Therefore I sent him the more eagerly, that when you see him again you may rejoice, and that I may be less sorrowful. Receive him therefore in the Lord with all gladness, and hold such men in esteem. Now this flaw, if you'd like to call it that, serving too much, this flaw, serving too much, is not the greatest shortcoming in the world. In fact, if you had to have one problem which you had not overcome by the time Jesus Christ returns, let it be this one. I serve too much. Verse 30, because for the work of Christ he came close to death, not regarding his life to supply what was lacking in your service to me. You see what's going on here? If everybody had been contributing to the necessity of the saints and using their talents, you know, for God's purpose and God's work, then Epaphroditus would not have had to make up all this slack, is what's implied here. This burnout was not necessary. If everyone had been pulling his own weight and serving, the solution then is that all of us need to be attentive to the needs of others. Use our strengths and distribute as we are able those strengths to those in need. It is the many hands principle. Many hands make light work. Now think for a moment. Have we filled a need in someone's life recently? A need, not a want, a desire, but have we filled a need in someone's life recently? Do we do so regularly? Single people, have you filled someone's needs recently? Those of you that are poor or sick or lonely, have you gone out of your way to fill someone's needs recently? You know what you'll discover if you're lonely or depressed and you sacrifice and go out of your way to help somebody else? You feel better. Every single time that I've gone out to visit someone or anoint someone where I could have sent an anointed cloth, but they're really sick and it was a long way or whatever, but, you know, I went every time, I won't say I went every time, but the times that I did, and by the time I got home, I always felt much better. I always felt like I had done something of value in those moments and those times. Sacrifice, you know, requires giving up something. Otherwise, it's not sacrifice. No one is expected to do what he's unable to do. That's a given. But all of us may be able to help in more ways than we ever imagined. Our accompanist in West Palm Beach is blind and has been blind since birth. And she has even helped out at the feast on occasion. She taught herself to play the piano. The only problem is that as an accompanist, you follow her, she doesn't follow you. When you find someone at college, we got spoiled when we practiced song leading because we had the finest pianists at college. And we, as students, would practice, and you could be leading slow, and then you'd speed up, and the accompanist would keep up with you no matter what you did, or hold notes. But then I got into church area, and reality sunk in. Some of our accompanists, you know, they just have one way of playing and head down. But Mary Klesch, our accompanist in West Palm Beach, you have to give her the hymns in advance. She goes over, she knows basically how to play them, but she practices. And once she starts, that's it. I mean, once she starts going, that's it. But she's been able to render great service to the church. You think, well, someone blind couldn't help out. Well, she does. So can the handicapped ever do anything to enrich the life of a muscle-bound, hormone-popping fitness guru of a young adult? Sure. How about a meal? Unable to cook, how about buying a meal for this person? Unable to cook or buy, how about explaining what a good meal is? And you heard in the sermonette about food at our house. I hope you're still doing that all. I know the peanut butter jar didn't have any liquid on top of it. And if you can't explain what a good meal is, how about a recipe for healthy, low-fat lasagna? How about bringing a book to one of our single fellows on 2,000 ways to fix, disguise, and embellish and rearrange hamburger? What does it take to supply someone's needs? What does it take to supply someone's needs? Number one, it takes a caring attitude. Somebody that cares. Somebody that's interested. Somebody that wants to help. And number two, the effort to really get to know our brothers and sisters in Christ, especially across intergenerational lines, especially with those who are different from us. That's what it takes. What this will do immediately is get our focus into an outgoing direction instead of inward. Mr. Armstrong always described love very simply. He said it is outgoing concern for others. Love cannot be obtained. Love cannot be gotten. Love can only be given. You can only give love. For God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son. But the beautiful thing about love is the more you give, the more you get back. It is so easy to focus on our needs instead of the needs of others. So when is the last time that we realized that God had truly done something through us? When is the last time you realized that God had just done something through you? I remember the very first funeral I ever conducted. I was so nervous. I mean, I've been speaking for many years, but a funeral was just different. There was a person horizontal behind me, stiff as a board. Everybody was grieving. I was 23 years old. What did I know? And I was nervous. I couldn't have had enough water to get the dryness out of my mouth. My knees were shaking so much, they were just not knocking, they were passing one another by behind the lectern. And I thought, this is not going to go well. This is not going to help these people out here that want to be comforted, whatever. And all the way up, right till I got up there, I was unsure what was going to happen. As soon as I got up there, all of the butterflies completely disappeared. And then when I sat down after it was over, they came back. And I just thought, I looked up there and I thought the empty lectern, I thought, who was that man? Mr. Waterhouse used to say the same thing. Faith is a good part of sermon preparation. Trust in God. A few years ago, we were at a ministerial seminar, and we're having a lecture from someone, young person in the ministry, explaining to us how to give more effective sermons. And had to do something along the lines of inductive reasoning or whatever, I forget by now. And it was about an hour and a half long, and after it was over, I asked for any questions, and Mr. Waterhouse put up his hand, and he said, you know, I've never heard a presentation in God's church for an hour and a half on how to give an effective sermon without once mentioning the inspiration of God. The inspiration of God. So you don't want to leave that out, certainly. So love is outgoing concern for one another, because it is in the outgoing direction, away from the self, that we will discover all, every single one, all of the weightier matters of God's law.